Hello and welcome to this latest podcast in our series on the early 19th century German writer Heinrich von Kleist. I'm Steve Howe from the University of Exeter, and I'm joined by Professor Ricardo Schmidt, also from the University of Exeter, and Dr. Sean Allen from the University of Warwick. And today we will be talking about another of Kleist's stories, The Marquise of O. First published in 1808 and later revised in 1810, the story is arguably Kleist's best-known work of fiction. The subject matter is introduced, fairly typically for Kleist, by way of a quite startling opening line, which here tells of an announcement which the widowed Marquise of O, a lady of unblemished reputation, as the narrator notes, has placed in the local newspaper. There we read that, quote, "She had, without knowledge of the cause, come to find herself in a certain situation, that she would like the father of the child she was expecting to disclose his identity to her, and that she was resolved, out of consideration for her family, to marry him." So if we could perhaps start with you, Sean, could you give us a brief sense of how and why it comes to this quite extraordinary step on the Marquise's part?
There's an attack on the citadel where the Marquise lives. She's just on the point of being raped by a gang of low-ranking Russian soldiers, and she's rescued by the Count F, the main male protagonist in the story. And he's, of course, the man who eventually confesses to being the father of this child, because as she lies unconscious, she's impregnated by the Count F. I use the word impregnated because there is some debate, I think, in the critical literature as to whether it is a rape or not a rape. I personally see it quite unambiguously as a rape. As the story unfolds, I think there's absolutely no doubt that the Count F is the rapist and that he's the father of the child. And in fact, at the end of the story, the mother says when he turns up, "Who else have we been expecting?"
And that's revealed through a series of clues over the course of the text.
Yes, not just a series of clues, I think some very, very obvious allusions and statements. A contemporary reviewer writing on this story said, "You can soon tell how it's all going to end out." So I think it's fair to say, too, that even in Kleist's day, there's no ambiguity about who is the father of the child.
And so alongside the question of the identity of the father, I think the opening line also raises certainly curiosity on the part of the readers as to how it could possibly be that the Marquise has fallen pregnant without her knowledge. I think the three of us would agree that it's unambiguously a rape. Though readers and commentators, both in Kleist's own time and in our own, have questioned the Marquise's innocence and suggested that she is in fact guilty of suppressing sexual knowledge, that she's somehow complicit in the act. Ricardo, if you could perhaps firstly sense of the lines upon which those types of readings are constructed, and secondly, you know, what you would make of them.
The story has the Marquise learn that the Count, who first appeared to her like an angel from heaven, towards the end he appears to her like the devil. So she has to learn about human frailty, that there's not an easy division between good and evil, angel and devil, but there's all these shades of grey. Now, understandably, this attempt to map out the human frailty in the 20th century was then being applied to women as well. In the story itself, it's the Marquise who has to make this discovery and apply it to her relationship with the Count. In the 20th century, critics wanted to apply the same kind of insight into human frailty into the Marquise herself. So how did they do that? They were trying to attribute to her some dark side, and the dark side is sexual desire, repressed sexual desire. And critics hung it on the connotations of the verb to know and knowledge. It was interpreted as biblical knowledge, carnal knowledge. So sentences in which anything with knowing and knowledge appeared were read in this sexual sense. And in one scene, the Marquise says to the Count, when he comes to woo her in the garden, that she doesn't want to know anything. And critics said, oh, she is trying to repress sexual knowledge. I think that is quite misguided, because in that scene, the Marquise by then has discovered her pregnancy, and has decided that for family considerations she wants to marry her rapist in order to give the father a child. And the Count, coming to woo her again because she doesn't associate him with the rape, seems to be the wrong man. So, you know, she quite likes him but doesn't want to have him as the wrong man. She doesn't feel she's worthy of him, having been in this strange situation. So I think it's understandable that 20th century critics are trying to, you know, establish equality and not view women as so pure. But I think this story is actually hinged that the Marquise is as pure in order for the whole frailty of the world not to lead into utter chaos. You know, she is the Archimedean point in this story where everything else turns out to be not black and white, but grey. But, you know, she, I would argue, is the firm moral centre that doesn't waver.
I would certainly agree with you on that reading, and I think it's interesting that this idea that the Marquise isn't perhaps as pure as she maintains is also rehearsed in the story itself. I mean, the father, the commandant, her brother, they all take this very sceptical view of her sexuality, and I think it's a view that's shown to be misguided. And indeed, even that, if you think about that epigram that Kleist wrote when he satirised contemporary reactions to the novel, he says, "This is not a novel for you, my daughter. Unconscious, what a brazen performance, I'm telling you. All she just did it with her eyes shut." And, of course, readers at Kleist's time also found it hard to believe, but I think that's precisely the power of the story, as you've so rightly pointed out.
Yes, and I think Kleist wasn't trying to make her out as aiming for female emancipation. The story has often been read as a story of female emancipation because when she finds herself pregnant, all the world is against her. The world primarily meaning her father, her mother, her brother. She's cast out of the house. So socially isolated, and in this social isolation she finds it in herself to resist her quite violent father, the famous pistol shot. But in a typical Kleistian reversal, you know, when something happens that could crush her, she then finds power to resist this. But it's a resistance that is not aimed at an overthrow of patriarchy, because at no point does she ever want independence. She doesn't reject the authority of her parents. At all times she honours and loves them. So what she is acting out of is a sense of honourability, obligation. And that goes back, interestingly, to Cicero. To act in an honourable way for Cicero means that you've got everybody in life has different obligations, and they've got to be weighed up. Honourable obligations derive from those that pursue truth. Second, justice and benevolence. And third, which display magnanimity. And fourth, order and measure in her actions. So the Marquise, when she decides after finding herself pregnant, she wants to find the father of her child. It would be easier for herself if she didn't. But she does it for the sake of the child. So she acts honourably to protect somebody weaker than herself. And she is trying to find out the truth, whereas it would have been much easier for her had she tried to follow the midwife's advice of how to cover it up. So her acting honourably means that she puts a lot of what is regarded as proper feminine behaviour as secondary, because she prioritises the interests of the unborn child.
So in those terms, Ricardo, you would think that the Marquesa is presented by Christ in the text as an embodiment of a kind of feminine virtue, a particular model.
Yes, but interestingly, he shows feminine virtue as much more complex because it shows there are contradicting demands on feminine virtue. And the Marquesa is strong enough to accept the censure of the world in order to protect a weak person, well, the unborn child.
It's interesting, too, because if you compare this story with another story that Kleist wrote that's related in some way, it's called, I think, A Remarkable Occurrence That Occurred During a Sojourn in Italy, and there a maid becomes pregnant, and there is, if you like, a kind of cover-up where the princess organises a husband for her maid, Francisca. And I think in this story, The Marquesa from O, we get a lot of attempts to try and provide sort of pseudo-conventional solutions. I mean, as the Count knows that he's the father of the child, he turns up immediately and proposes in this very impetuous way that he would like to marry the Marquesa. Everyone's taken aback, of course. And it's interesting that this is a sort of solution that would, in fact, solve appearances, but I think that that points to the more radical dimension of the story, which is, of course, lies at its ethical heart. And if I was to come back to that very rich phrase that you were talking about, I don't want to know anything, ich will nichts wissen, she says. And I always think, what is it that she doesn't want to know? And of course, what she doesn't want to be told by the Count is that even though you have been raped, you are innocent. Because, of course, she knows that she is innocent. She doesn't need to be told that. Of course, I find what's at the heart of the story is that the Count really has to confess, I am the guilty person. And that's really what makes this story so powerful and so radical.
And because the Count hasn't done that, and because he appeared like an angel, you know, all the obvious clues, she is just unable to interpret them, which, of course, makes for the rich irony, the humour of the story. So it's quite remarkable that Kleist managed to write a serious story about rape, which is at the same time immensely funny, immensely comical.
Yes, I think that's a side of Kleist's work that's very often overlooked, this dark humour. And I think that's something that's made him of particular interest, I think, to 20th century readers. I certainly see that would be a connection. Sometimes these conventions are hard to embrace, I think, for us in our contemporary world. But this humour, I think, was something that particularly appealed to Franz Kafka. There's, I think, a line of continuity there in their style.
Yes, and it even goes far back, because it goes back to Rousseau's Nouvelle Louise. And it's well known that Nouvelle Louise is a source for the reconciliation scene between father and daughter. But it's also a source with regard to the family constellation. I mean, in Rousseau's Julie or the Nouvelle Louise, the father is described as an old soldier who was obstinate about the honour of his house. And Rousseau's father figure is described as a person of violent temper, a bit of a tyrant, flaring into a rage very easily. So, and the mother is conciliatory. So that same family constellation Kleist takes over. And in Nouvelle Louise, heroine is not innocent. She actually had sex with her lover illicitly. And the irony comes that her father knows of the love affair but doesn't suspect that it actually has been sexually consummated. And there's the scene where Julie tells the story how her father actually berated her and he actually hit her. And calls her names, is really violent and unpleasant, and you know, blood flows because he hits her so badly that she falls over. And Julie comments that all the time, while he called her all sorts of bad names, he never suspected that she'd actually had sex with this man. So that, you know, to notice something and criticize it, and yet completely failing to get the point, that is something he got from Rousseau and then transferred it onto the Count, because the family are making all sorts of remarks about the Count's odd behaviour without suspecting for a moment how close they are to the truth. Kleist has certainly put a lot of things in that Rousseau didn't, because in Rousseau, it's the daughter who initiates and manufactures this reconciliation scene. She is the one who kisses the father in Rousseau. Here, it's the other way around. The Marquise is lying back, and the father covers her with kisses like a lover. So the emotions involved in the father, who had idolized the daughter, who had apparently betrayed him, and then being convinced that he was wrong and she is as pure as he had wanted her to be, just releases emotions that I have to confess, I find them still quite hard to bear.
Would you say that's fairly typical for what Kleist does in terms of engaging with literary predecessors? Because as you say, there's so much that he does take from Rousseau in that scene, certain of the elements, even the fact that the father can't express his guilt is very much in the Rousseau as well. But Kleist takes it in such a... or pushes it to such extremes, so to speak. And if he does, why do you think necessarily?
I think he is basically an idealist who nevertheless likes to test the ideals against reality, because he wants the ideals and yet notices the discrepancies between the ideals and reality. So he is somebody who in his writing sets up little examples and tests them to the limit.
I would see this also as a way of exploring the way in which certain kinds of ideals become conventionalized, that there is a sort of genuine moral impulse, or whether for good or for evil, actually, in terms of the rape, and this becomes reduced to a set of formulaic conventions that characters form. And I think he was always interested in these literary models that give you a kind of pattern of how to act, but yet somehow actually obscure the real moral content of the action. And I think here, this story, part of the humour derives from the fact that the characters are trapped in a certain type of conventional world and have to negotiate their positions despite the blindingly obvious with which they're confronted. And that allows for a kind of humour, I think precisely that kind of black humour that we were talking about. I always think that if we come to the figure of the father is sort of trapped in this conventional world where he has to follow these kind of military conventions as he surrenders his citadel, and he says he wanted to surrender the whole time, but he'd just been waiting for an order to do so. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, I think his convention-bound behaviour results in a kind of hysterical personality, almost, that he shoots from one extreme to the other. Of all the characters in the novella, he has these very, very violent mood swings.
I think, the father is very much criticised for that, and he nearly loses his power in the family because of that. So, I think although the Marquise stands up against her father when he wants to take away the children from her, it doesn't mean that patriarchy as such is being criticised. What is being criticised is somebody who hasn't got what Cicero argued was order and measure in his behaviour, because he always overreacts, reacts in a violent way, whereas the Marquise herself, although she stands up against her father, she always has the order and measure in her behaviour, and in that she herself is a model of moral behaviour. Because, when her mother comes to see her in her country estate, she immediately rushes out and falls on her knees before the coach in which her mother sits. And, she says she had never stopped to love and honour her, and it was completely understandable given the situation that nobody could believe her. So she is full of empathy and measure and respect, shows respect to both her parents at all times.
I think you're right that I don't think this novella challenges what I would call patriarchal structures, but I'm interested in the way in which, in the novella, the reactions to the pregnancy there's a very different sort of reaction according to the gender of the person. Because another character we haven't talked about yet is the midwife. And it always seems to me that the midwife and the mother, they have a rather different attitude to sort of sexual relations. Because the mother says, if you'd had sex with somebody, I would find that pretty reprehensible, but it was something I, for which I could forgive you. Actually, the brother and the father couldn't really forgive her for that. I think that's very clear. And of course, the midwife, she says, oh, you know, all these ladies who thought they lived on desert islands, you know, in the end, the gay corsair turns up and so on. And of course, she is a wheeler and a dealer, a fixer of, and she understands that for these aristocratic families, what matters really is, of course, that everything turns out nicely, as she so eloquently puts it.
But what is so interesting is that whenever somebody who has power, like the Count, like the father, if they don't show measure and control in their behaviour, they are threatened with losing it. And it's the women who both are agents into making them lose it, but ultimately in this story also to regain it.
Absolutely.
So, because in the end, after the father has humiliated himself in the reconciliation scene, and the mother insisted, he comes here, you don't go to him, and, you know, he comes and asks for forgiveness. After he's done that, when the Marquisa then finds out who her rapist was and doesn't want to marry him, the father insists you must marry him, and the father negotiates the marriage contract. So, you know, it's with the moderate behaviour, the measured moral behaviour, the honourable behaviour of the women, patriarchy is shorn up again. And that's something which also has an intriguing background in Rousseau. I mean, if you read his Julie, this Julie, although, you know, she tries to conform to feminine virtues, apart from her fall, but, you know, she orders her lover about quite a lot and says, well, you know, once he is drunk and behaves sexually aggressive inappropriately to her, uses bad language, and she tells him, you know, either you renounce me or you married my esteem. Bang. So the moral stance they take, and I find that is really intriguing, the power that women have in patriarchy. It's a sort of a soppy sentimentalist view to think the power consists of rejecting patriarchy. Women have a lot more power if they embrace patriarchy and can say morally on the high ground, well, you know, I'm behaving honourably and properly, etc. And the men don't, because they are falling for their passions rather than being measured. Mm-hmm. So that is what gives them a lot more power than opposing patriarchy outright. Kleist is absolutely fantastic in showing that following, protecting the interests of the children, women can outgrow their role in a patriarchal society in so many other ways, but they don't ever intend to outgrow it. You know, their power is completely based on the acceptance of the patriarchal role of the self-sacrificing mother. Outside that, they haven't got power. They haven't got power for themselves. You know, they're never rulers, successful rulers in their own right or independence. No, their strength lies completely in the moral behaviour, in protecting others, and where they're so honourable that, you know, they make all sorts of sacrifices, they offend all sorts of norms, because that is such a priority, this honourable behaviour, protecting weaker ones. And in this story, we've got the happy ending, because he's of the same rank, and they can marry, and she is magnanimous enough to forgive him.
And that does only occur eventually. The point that Sean was alluding to in the text, where the initial reaction when she finds out that the Count is the rapist, and she has this where she announces that, yes, she was prepared to meet a vicious man, but not a devil. Then she throws holy water over her parents and her brother. I mean, what do you think the Marquisa is experiencing at that point?
Utter shock, because, you know, she had idealised him. into an angel. And, you know, when he came back to her and wanted to renew the wooing, she just thought, oh, he knew that she was pregnant and he was being very kind, but she just had never connected that moment to a possible rape. So this shock that her idealization was misplaced, that he has misused her trust, betrayed her trust, is a very deep shock for the Marquise.
Okay, I think that brings us to a nice close. Thank you very much, Ricardo Schmidt and Sean Allen.